My name's Neil Goodwin. I'm wear various hats, but for most of my life, I've been a filmmaker. Even till quite recently, I've been making films. I went to the London College of Printing in the late 80s. Friend Gareth, who were both on the course, we started making a documentary about travellers and free festivals and the party scene. And ended up morphing into a Beanfield documentary called Operation Solstice. So that was my into documentary filmmaking as a second year student, and then became a video activist in the 90s and covered a lot of things like the M11 and Newbury, and as camera equipment became cheaper and that it became sort of semi broadcast quality, we could do, find ourselves filming stuff, getting the tip off to an action or something, filming it in the early hours. They always used to slap a thing saying amateur footage, which was a bit, yeah, that, so we got the inside story of everything, and then we palm it off to the media, and they'd soak it up because it would look grainy and look dodgy. I mean, one of the examples would be the Millennium Time Bombers, who took over the Millennium Dome in, I think, 99. And I went in there with them at 5 o'clock in the morning, or actually 3 o'clock in the morning, filmed it, and then whisk, as they were getting up on the gantry, they took over one of the gantries, or one of the spikes that comes out of the Millennium Dome. And I'll hot tailed it back to the squat that I was living in at the time, and phoned around the media and managed to get it out there. So that was my wing, the propaganda wing of the environmental movement, really. So and I've been doing it ever since, really, bits and pieces. It's amazing now because you can make a film, whereas before you'd make a film and put it on VHS and arm it round and do a screening. You'd be lucky you've got 250 people turning up to a screening. Now, what you do is you kind of make a film, upload it to YouTube, and if you've got enough subscribers, that by the end of the session, it's been seen by thousands of people. I mean, one of the films that I put up recently, Dale Vince, an interview with Dale Vince about the Beanfield, because he was on it. I mean, he was the outrider on the day. I mean, that's at 13,000 views, and that's the miracle of the age we're in. It's we used to fight hard to do a little screening, put a
There
lot
is
of effort
a bit
into
of a
flyers.
difference, though. I mean, in that,
Sorry, mate.
surely there is a bit of a difference in that, your Solstice film was shown on mainstream TV, as I understand it. I mean, that it's a different world in the 1980s, with people like Channel 4 saying, "Yeah, come on, if you've got a decent documentary, we're not going to fuss too much about the political content. Get on with it."
Yeah, I mean, we were lucky in that I mean, this was the thing. The remit of Channel 4 kind of changed. Minority issues sort of shifted from, I don't know, the travellers and squatters and, other groups to other, I don't know, basket weaving became a minority issue. It all shifted. Their remit changed in the 80s, I mean, in the 90s. And we were lucky. We were just on the cusp, and Critical Eye was the documentary strand that we were involved in. And they looked at really hard hitting stuff. There was a lot of undercover stuff going on. A friend of mine, Zoe, she went in under Huntington Life Science, and it was undercover Britain. It was a different era of investigative journalism, and it really, I mean, it was difficult to get stuff out, and every so often, we'd all sit around watching Spitting Image, and that was like our one time of the week where we felt like we were getting something over on the mainstream media and on the government, stuff didn't get through. Very rarely. Dispatches was another one. Critical Eye, yeah, as I've mentioned. And so it's amazing that Solstice did go out, because the college tried to ban us twice because we were difficult students. We wanted to cover a Beanfield trial, which lasted 4 months, and they wanted us to put our documentary option into a 2-week little slice, you know. So we were away on the road, living on site, and going to the Beanfield trial at Winchester Crown Court, you know, as much as we could. You know, we'd got this story, and it gripped hold of us. And it was, as far as the college was concerned, well, you know, you've got to be at a tutorial Monday morning, mate. No, we've got to be in the trial watching the verdict, mate. That's why. So
Well, I think that
we got
what you've
banned.
just touched on there, getting in the grip of a story, it seems to me more formulaic now, where somebody in an office is an editor is dictating, right, this is going to be what this documentary is about, this is what we're going to find, blah blah. But it sounds to me like what you're doing is you're actually there telling a story as it happens, and you've not necessarily got any idea where the end point's going to be.
Exactly. I mean, I'll give you an example. On the day of the verdict, when the travellers had been screwed over in the Beanfield trial, two police officers tried to, well, basically drove into site at full speed through the mud, slishing around in a police car, and deliberately smashed into the back of a van on site, trying to create, you know, a scene so that, you know, they could call up some riot cops from whatever, Bristol or wherever they were going to get them, and you know, get them all evicted as soon as, but without realize. I mean, this is what happens with, you know, with when your documentary happens, things just occur. It's the real time. It's like gifts, or you know, just stuff happens, and you've got to surf that. You've just got to be in the right place at the right time with enough battery power and in focus, and you know, don't screw up the sound or anything, but you've just got to capture it, and that's your job as a documentary filmmaker. And it, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. We didn't know that those cops were going to deliberately try and provoke a fight on site, and they didn't realize that one of the buses had like the entire legal team from you know, that'd been fighting the case, including Lord Gifford, doing a kind of briefing after the trial, and they were like, everyone comes out of the bus, and there's these two cops thinking, you know, I think he said to the one guy when he hit the van, he said to the one guy when he came out and sort of said, "What are you doing, mate?" You know, the cop said, "Well, you shouldn't have parked it there." So, and then suddenly the door opens on Field of Beer's bus, and there's like the entire legal team, all these QCs and everything coming out, surrounding this cop car, loads of travellers there, and also me and Gareth with the camera, you know, zooming in on the cops, sort of thing. So it was, yeah, we didn't know that was going to happen. There's so many things. I mean, you know, like so many examples of things that happened over time that you've just got to go with it. You know, make
Yeah,
sure
well,
you're
and
in
also
focus.
you've got to do this is, now, you know, also that would be quite a high budget film, wouldn't it? If you've got to have a crew sitting around quite often doing nothing, or nothing actually happening to film, and just being there in case something like that happens. But look, you know, the other aspect of this, Neil, is the legal side. Nowadays, it's become much more since Ken Clark stripped away much of legal aid. I think it was about 2011. Suddenly, people are left scrabbling around to find a lawyer. It's not a very easy thing to do, especially if you haven't got a lot of money in your pocket.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what saved me, because I was on trial a couple of times last year, and what actually saved, because I wasn't sleeping, you know, you're kind of worried about, I don't know, people breaking the door down. One of my prized possessions is a penny black, and you kind of like lying awake at night, you know, thinking that the bailiffs are going to turn up and smash a door down and nick your stamp collection. And just, but I spoke to Green and Black legal people. Just cut. They're just amazing. You know, they really calm the nerves legal wise, and you know, give you that kind of almost instant reassurance about certain things. Now, mate, you're not going to get a £10,000 fine. You know, it's a certain kind of case, and you're looking at maybe a couple of hundred quid. So you start to sleep at night, you know, and you don't have to wait around for, I don't know, weeks to speak to someone at Byman's, who are probably too busy because they've got a million Just Stop Oil people to deal with. You can speak to them straight away. So it's Green and Black. That's a really good tip to get some legal advice. And if you can, in any way, chuck a couple of quid their way, because they're doing an amazing job. And they fill that gap, that void, that legal void where, you might have to wait weeks to speak to someone. They'll just sort you out that afternoon. They'll phone you back,
Well, amazing. It's also, it's reassurance. That's what you're getting, isn't it? Which is so important that in that legal minefield. Look, so much of, I mean, you're talking about the bean field here. That's obviously, quite a big thing you were involved in right at the very start. And it's kind of shaped maybe some of the stuff you've done in the past after that. But there was also around that time there was whopping, there was a mass and there is a there was a very good Despite the Sun, it's called. Mark
Despite
Saunders,
TV. Yeah,
Mark,
that's right. Mark
Mark
Saunders.
Saunders and his film about that. Then there was the poll tax. There's also the poll tax riots film, which
Yeah,
is
Battle
the
for
Battle of
Trafalgar.
Trafalgar. All this stuff was actually going out on telly. I don't know if Despite the Sun did, but certainly a lot of it was at the time, which is amazing now. And then there was the miners' strike happening in the 1980s. Thatcherism, I think, for us at the time, I remember getting in my mum's Mini and driving up and down Whitehall when she was booted out, Margaret Thatcher eventually, playing, I think, was it the beat Stand Down Margaret, really loud, and just being so happy about the end of Thatcher. But what do you make of looking back now at Thatcher? What was she really up to?
She was up to creating Tony Blair for one thing. She was up to creating this kind of very sick situation where, deregulations flog off everything worth having, flog off all the council houses. Eventually, they'll all be privatized and turned into, they'll go private. No more national control over anything. Your water's controlled maybe by someone from Spain, or whatever. And yeah, she was up to basically what the situation we're in at the moment. But certainly with regards to police powers, she's basically using the MOD. She was using the army to smash the miners, and she was using the army to smash the travellers. And she probably had to go. I mean, this year is also the 40th anniversary of Broadwater Farm, which probably won't. I don't know whether it's going to get a mention, but inner city, quelling inner city riots and situations, by creating a paramilitarized police force, which is what they what one of the things that Thatcher achieved. She created this kind of police state through ACPO and this convalescing of all the different kind of police authorities into one big coordinated,
Well, I noticed
police.
the Met Chief Constable Mark Rowley this week has just been calling for something like halving the number of independent police forces, centralising power even more. But look, you just mentioned Broadwater Farm. A lot of people won't, including me. I mean, I can remember the name, but I'm not sure what happened. What was that about?
Well, Cynthia Jarrett, she got killed by the police. I think she was severely stressed out, died on the spot. And that's a lot of these things occur because of the overreach of the police. And unfortunately, it's when people get murdered by the state, and people, it's just the tip of the iceberg. It's not like just because Cynthia Jarrett died, there was a riot. It was like, well, there was, so many deaths in custody, this was just the tipping point, so there was a riot on, Broadwater Farm Estate in Tottenham, which went on for a few days, basically. Shots of the police in full riot gear, holding off the youth. Who were, well, not just the youth, but the entire community was outraged by what had happened, and so there we had scenes of inner city. I mean, they'd created this whole riot city. I think I'm not, is it Hendon or somewhere like that, where they were doing police training. You went from a policeman in 1958, the Bobby on the beat, the friend of the community, to suddenly people firing, rubber bullets behind shields and kind of with helmets and all the rest of it at Riot City, training for Broadwater Farm, you know, because they knew that, you know, they wanted to push people into a corner, and they knew that the people invariably would rise up. So they were getting their ducks in a line in terms of how they were going to sort it out, you know,
Well, I
and
mean,
that's
it's
what they
even
did.
basic stuff, Neil. Like, since I arrived in Bristol in the 1990s, we don't have community cops anymore. It used to be a guy called Blackbeard around here. Everybody knew him as a cop. He had quite a good relationship with him. If there was trouble, he knew the individual characters. Nothing now at all. They keep swapping them around. They move the police around. And also, of course, we've got now this confrontational style policing coming through the proscription of Palestine Action. So it'd be interesting to see what you make. I mean, this is almost another step. The idea that people just peace activists lying down in the street suddenly become targets for arrest, and it's a serious crime, according to the Met Chief Constable.
Yeah, it's serious overreach. I mean, what you're looking at really is criminal damage. I mean, it's funny because, well, I say funny in a kind of like, not funny, but, you know, Keir Starmer actually, you know, represented activists that were involved in direct action that led to criminal damage against war planes, you know, in the 90s. And, you know, he's on record as saying that it was justified, and I think he got people off on those charges, you know, when he was a QC. And you know, now, you know, he's just gone back on all that. Now it's not a crime to prevent a greater crime anymore. You know, the crime of there can't be anything worse than the crime of genocide. You know, because it's the sum total of the most disgusting crimes, and you know, terrible crimes. I must just say one thing before I forget, and I always kick myself because I never get this one out. 40% of the population of Gaza is 15 and under, you know. So the situation we have here at the moment is Israel battle testing its arsenal before usually an arms fair on a civilian population in Gaza, which are like just rats in a barrel, as far as they're concerned. Let's try this missile out, let's try that missile out, and then flog it later, you know. But yeah, 40% of the population of Gaza is 15 and under. That's hundreds of thousands of babies, hundreds of thousands of toddlers, hundreds of thousands of really young teens, you know. It's just absolutely disgusting.
One of the
And
most upsetting things I've seen is the kids saying that they want to die because their friends have died, their parents have died, this sort of thing, that they want to die. And these are like sort of 4, 5 year olds.
I know, you know, and partly what this is doing is trying to rob us of our humanity, and it's trying to quieten us, it's trying to chill us, it's trying to make us go mad because suddenly we're like, oh no, it's not, it's just a genocide. Get on with your life, you know. Yeah, enjoy the festival, whatever, you know. Enjoy the tennis, you know. It's just a genocide. They're trying to make us complicit in it through our silence and our lack of basically they're trying to destroy our humanity, because if they can get away with this genocide, and when it all kicks off with climate change, and suddenly you've got, you know, yeah, Africa, what we only need a few resources from it. Let's just, you know, don't worry about all these people dying. They're trying to like destroy our humanity so that we turn a blind eye to other atrocities that
Yeah,
they've got lined up for the future, you
maybe
know?
you're right, and certainly it seems interesting that they've chosen the Holy Land to do this, to turn into hell.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just, I mean, you know, what are they kidding, man? I mean, they're fighting over a scrap of land that's going to be decimated by climate change. You know, I mean, we have 40 degree, we're edging towards 40 degree heat. You can feel it. You know, it's only July. We've still got August to go, and now going into September, you know, Indian summers is a thing. And we all felt that 40 degree heat and what it meant. And where someone who suffers from MS, it means that my body turns to jelly. You know, it just affects me. The extreme heat affects what little mobility I've got. And I mean, as for Israel, I mean, what are they kidding? We're heading towards a climate breakdown, and they're just, I don't know, what are they fighting over? I mean, I've got a photograph on my Instagram page, of a flag burning in Tel Aviv, the Israeli flag burning in Tel Aviv through the fierce fires that they suffered from recently. I mean, we're wasting time with, in all this resources on war, when we really need to get our act together and get organized
Okay, but you
for
need to
survival.
explain something to me about the climate business because I interviewed some people from a group called Stop Burning Trees recently. Now they're talking about the government Department for Climate Change with Ed Miliband, the failed Labour leader now in charge. They're burning millions of trees in the Drax power station, and these are old trees being shipped over from virgin forests in the United States. So this is hardly going to be a solution to climate change, and yet the government are sitting there subsidizing this stuff, saying it's clean energy.
I don't know. I mean, the conspiracy theory in me would say that we're being pushed into a situation where there is a planet, a collapse in our resources, in our food, basically. And that to me is that what's the end game here? That's I try not to go there too far because dealing with what's literally happening as opposed to what may be happening, is enough. But there is this thing called a climate emergency and a crisis, and we've said all along that the food chain is just going to collapse, and we've got 9 billion people on the planet. We're just pushing it and pushing it and pushing it, and it's all these huge cargo ships coming from China with Temu and whoever selling all this stuff, man. It's just I think it could be said that our consumption is going up and up and up, not like in any way going down. We're consuming more and more items which involve cardboard boxes and and freight and all the rest of it. It's just I don't know. We're gonna hit the, we're coming into station, the train brakes have failed. Everyone's in the buffet car eating their food and oblivious to it, and we're going to hit the buffet soon. And everyone in the buffet car who's tucking into their food and joking and whatever are going to feel it, and they're going to be shocked. There's going to be a lot of people out there seriously shocked by this. I
Well,
mean,
yeah,
we
I
know.
mean the other thing is the if there is things do kick off. It was very interesting recently when the Americans hit Iran that the fuel price didn't go up. I look at that and I think, oh right, well that was all staged then. But of course, if it does kick off and the oil supplies from the Middle East do dry up, the Houthis start sinking tankers or just stealing them rather than harassing them. Then the oil, I mean, which electric, all those people with electric cars are going to have a big smile on their face. I mean, there are all sorts of potential shocks to come, Neil. But I just wanted to ask you about the one of the major crises, which doesn't really get talked about much, which is housing, which I suppose is in a way where you started with the travellers and the bean field. This whole idea of living as a traveller now in Bristol, I mean, it's like a pressure cooker here. It's so impossible to afford rent, and certainly many people who've embarked on a mortgage over the last 15 years or so are now finding that almost impossible to pay. Housing has got to, you've got to live somewhere, and so that's why we've now got something like 800 people in caravans and mobile homes and camper vans basically here in Bristol, living there because they can't afford the rent.
Did you say 800?
Yeah, it's
Or
about
did you?
between, they reckon around about 800 roughly.
Right. Yeah. Well, this is what happened. I mean, with the travelers situation in the 80s, our interview with Dale would Del Vince. He kind of said it quite well. And by the way, just to plug our documentary on the 40th anniversary of the Beanfield, Operation Solstice being updated. It's on, I must say this now before I forget, the beanfield.co.uk. There's a website and it's got all the films, all the archive. I just have to get that. Otherwise, when I forget, it's like, oh no, why don't I mention it? But anyway, from that, I think there were about 12,000 travelers living on the road in England, and it was growing year on year, with a thriving festival circuit that people could raise their, sell stuff and then fix up their vehicle in the winter. You know, that it was an alternative from living in a concrete, jungle, a nightmare, living in a decayed in a city, to get out in the, park up in a lay-by or a field or wherever, with friends. It was an option, and it was an option. It was an escape from what people were being forced to do, which was basically live in a quite a sick inner city area,
Yeah, but it was
and
also
that
getting
was great.
political with the peace convoy. It was getting political, wasn't it? Very political. They were turning up at places like Molesworth, Greenham Common, having big camps, peace camps, basically.
Molesworth, that's where the name the Peace Coin, Peace Convoy came from. They all turned up there, and they, parked. Again, there's very long interviews with Field of Beer talking about, it's on the website, talking about Molesworth and what happened there. It was quite a fluffy eviction by any stretch, even though there were like thousands of army and thousands of police, if you could believe it, bust in with Michael Heseltine turning up in a chopper with, with a flat camouflage jacket and perfect hair, and just, being seen to be I think it was one of the largest evictions in British history. I think it was something ridiculous. There were thousands of army and police, and it kicked them out on the road. And obviously, that was early 85. So from there, we went down to the Beanfield ultimately, but people were out on the road. It wasn't just people. It was highly motivated, people who were sussed on the issues of the day, who were actually taking direct action, living in vehicles at places like Molesworth and Greenham Common,
I
and
mean, how organised or scuzzy was it on site? Obviously, you've got to have some sort of toilet facilities, cooking facilities. You can't just turn up like 50 or 100 people and go away without leaving a mess. Was it was how well organised was it, Neil?
well, it's like leave no trace. That was the idea, it's leave the site as you found it, basically. I mean, there were firewood, hook or by crook, it was organized in the sense that people saw it as an extension of the ethos of the lifestyle, that you'd have to sort out these logistical problems, like where do you go to the loo, we're not talking about huge bogs at Glastonbury, it's not like that. It's a bit more kind of intimate in a way and personal, but it's like, you'd probably get into a lot of trouble if you went into the woods and someone hadn't sorted themselves out properly, and they created a mess, and you get into, you seriously frowned upon. Then you wouldn't do that anyway,
Well, what we
you'd
used to
keep.
do was dig pits and have a compost loo to put over the top of it, basically. It was always something to do with that.
Yeah.
Let's just get back to this because it's a big issue now, which is housing.
Sure.
What can we do
Yeah.
about it? People need somewhere to live, Neil. And here in Bristol, nothing's
Yeah.
been provided by the council virtually. The housing stock is there's other priorities for it, and so if you're not in some sort of special need of some kind, then you're going to go and have to live up on the downs in a caravan.
Yeah, that's the yeah, just pushing people into the city, penning them in, so don't want people all about scattered throughout the country in lay-bys and fields. Just rather have them corralled into an inner city with a nice ring road around it, so we can keep an eye on them. The last thing they, I mean, how much land is owned by the it's a couple, of hundred, maybe 100 families own 90% of the land. It's one of these facts you hear, there's a lot of land out there,
Well, actually,
but
the city council owns a lot of land. One of the people was mentioning here in Bristol when there were some discussions about this. Well, why doesn't the council just use some of its land and we can live there? We don't have to be necessarily up on the downs. Do you think there's a long-term solution to this though? Because it's getting worse and worse for people. Basically, the rent higher, the income, disposable income lower. Where can we take this? Any idea?
Well, it took Cathy Comes Home. It took a kind of a movement within the 60s, the Caravan Sites Act, to sort out to recognise that these are issues that needed to be tackled, and they were tackled in a level-headed way. They weren't tackled from a kind of a Daily Mail scare story way. They were dealt with, okay, these people want to do that. Let's manage this and make it, work for us all, basically. And it probably needs something like, I'll tell you what, it needs another. If you look at politics, it's slow politics, but if you look at politics, we obviously need a government that's willing to listen to the people and, find out what needs to be done and do it, basically. And this comes with it's not right that you work probably two jobs, sometimes three jobs, just to give your money to a modern day land baron, and have nothing at the end of the week. And it's like modern slavery. These people, when they do one house, and they'll use the money from that one house, build, get another
Well, yeah,
house, and
but
they've got.
this is what we've now. We haven't got any industry making anything. This property is the. Anyway, look, you use this
Sure,
speech
sure.
from you use the speech from the Great Dictator, don't you? I know I've seen you a few times doing this, Neil. What's that all about?
Well, I've done it for I originated it back in 2006 with Brian Hoare, when the seriously organized crime and police act, when Tony Blair was saying basically you can't come within a mile of Parliament without asking permission. So a lot of us just stood up against that law, anti-terror law, they'd say, but we actually saw it as an erosion of civil liberties and free speech. So I got the outfit together. I didn't learn the speech. I mean, I've been doing the Charlie Chaplin thing for 20 years now. I didn't learn the speech until 10 years later, and now I've got it, and it's more relevant than ever. It's quite chilling the way it actually, it could have been written yesterday, in terms of what's happening. So I do it, and I got arrested the other day at blocking Parliament, dressed as the Great Dictator. I didn't quite get as far as doing the speech, but I've got it ready to go, in my head, backwards. So basically, yeah,
Yeah, it is, and I
it's
think we'll have to play it. But what about your socials, websites? Where can people find and follow you? What are your latest films now?
Well, if you go on to at Counterculture 23 on YouTube, that's my channel. Like I say, I've got Neil Goodwin. What was it? Hold on a minute. No, sorry, no, thebeanfield.co.uk. That's where all the Beanfield stuff's gone, including all the archive, which we've digitized and saved. It was in someone's loft for 30 years, and we managed to save it. Well, Dell Vince paid for it to be saved, and that's out there. But yeah, the channel Counterculture, and there's a lot of stuff on there. I've hoovered up all these documentaries around over the years, a lot of traveler stuff, a lot of festival stuff, and it's quite rare stuff, which Reclaim the Streets, lots of 90s stuff on there, so check that out. Last Wednesday was my first arrest, dressed as the Great Dictator outside Downing Street. I was actually, I couldn't believe it, really. I mean, usually they'd have to wait for, this thing called Pixie 1 or Pixie 2, which is a specially modified van to take people on their mobility scooters, because, newsflash, disabled people also protest and also get arrested. And they didn't want to wait for Pixie One, so three of them picked me up and manhandled me into a waiting police van and interested the Great Dictator. And when they got me to the van, I think they kind of expected, oh, you've got me in the van, you can get up on the seat now. But no, they just plonked me on the floor of the van. I broke mine. I just said to them, look, mate, I can't move. I've got MS. I'm literally sitting on the floor. And then they worked it out that they have to sort of like help me every step of the way. So that was my first arrest as the Great Dictator. It felt good. I was holding a sign saying, this is what terrorism really looks like, with pictures of two starving children from Gaza, and that was it. It was on around the same time that organizations were being prescribed to, and kind of like being said there were terrorist organizations, and which is demeaning the word or what terrorism is,
That was the
I
very
saw.
Wednesday that Rachel Reeves was crying in the House of Commons at Prime Minister's questions, and the Prime Minister didn't even notice. He just at the end he just walked off. He didn't say anything to her. She was actually crying her eyes out, and
Well, sorry,
the great leader
what's
didn't even notice. That's the same day.
why was she crying?
Because she
I don't
thought
know
she
what.
might get the sack. For the government trying to push through the disabled cuts,
Right.
and they failed a lot of it anyway, and so I think that she was being blamed for that by the Prime Minister, maybe by other members of the cabinet, and so she
Yeah.
was in tears. I mean, it was quite amazing to see. So obviously she didn't get the sack. And it wasn't her fault. So this is the way this abusive relationship works that we call government. But anyway, so
Yeah.
just take us through why you were there and what happened. You were just talking about being bundled into a police van, Neil.
That's right. Yeah, they weren't going to wait around for suitable, this van called codename Pixie One, which has a little winch at the back and can take me on board on in my mobility scooter. They wanted to get me away as quickly as they can, so three of them picked me up basically and dragged me, well, not dragged me, carried me to a van and then dumped me on the floor of that van. And then like, okay, well, you can get on the seat now. And it's like, well, no, I can't move my legs, so because of the MS. And so then they kind of scratched their head and had to kind of get in, and then it was awkward bearing in mind I'm dressed as the Great Dictator. So and I said to the guy eventually, like, is that CCTV working in the van? Because I'd love to see footage of you basically manhandling a severely disabled man in this way, because of expediency, because you need to get me out of the way as soon as possible. And luckily someone filmed it, and I think last look, 200,000 people, and about six, maybe 6 to 8,000 people have shared it. 200,000 people have watched it, so it's out there, and also
So why did they
connections.
need to get you out of the way so quick, do you think?
It's Wednesday, and I don't know. I don't think they thought it through. I think they panicked. They had a big demonstration opposite, a huge like pro-Palestinian demonstration opposite, and I don't know. It's just weird. I mean, I think they just made a bad decision. I mean, anyone can see that I've got a completely fused neck and spine. It's not just the MS, but I've got ankylosing spondylitis as well. So if you look at me, you can kind of see that I'm fused. I can't move my neck at all. My neck, so yeah, I mean, and also the police in the past have waited. I mean, they had to wait a few hours to get this van. The last time I got arrested as Charlie outside the carriage entrance, which subsequently I got off on. I wasn't convicted, but I won my case. But they waited for a van, called Pixie One. They've also got Pixie Two. two vans to deal with. I mean, in the past, to get you to the station, they had to sort of beg passing cabs to sort of like, can you take this person in a wheelchair? We just arrested them to the police station. And the cab driver's gone, no, mate, it's not my job, mate. You know, they just haven't got
No.
the logistical wherewithal to deal with severely
Disabled
disabled
access to a Black
people.
Mariah.
Yeah, and also, you know, I think that's from what I gather is that they backed down because they didn't want, you know, I went to the demonstration, the welfare not warfare demonstration at Downing Street a few weeks ago, and literally they've got like 100 people with disabilities turning up on their doorstep with their carers. And I mean, you know, the fuss they had about 10 cops waiting for me to get that one van. But imagine if you had 20, you know,
I mean,
disabled
what do you
actors.
make of the disabled cuts? Because this is, I mean, many people are pointing to this and saying you cannot take these benefits away from disabled people. Disabled people rely on this, and if they don't get it, they're going to get suicidal or they may just die.
It's Pip is not just, I don't know, there's all these like nasty stories about Ferraris or people buying what, you know, whatever going on today, whatever. It's survival. It's you know, the amount of money, if you look at my bank account, it's like buying things like perching stools and grabbers. You've got to keep the update of your scooter, you've got to keep the update of your stair lifts. You know, you have to pay for all that stuff, and it comes out of the pip. It's survival. It's a leg up into actually existing in the world, you know, and that's what they were taking away from people. And it's highly stressed, and with MS, you get stressed, you get spasm attacks, and you know, and other people have got conditions where stress really affects them nastily, you know, and exacerbates their symptoms. So it's just like, you know, what they've done basically is stressed people out who really didn't need to be stressed. So it doesn't surprise me that people were suicidal, you know. You know, it's making a bad situation really worse, and it's cruel and it's unnecessary. And the sooner we get rid of this Tory-like government, the better. Actually, worse than the Tories, actually. I don't think the Tories should even pull this one off on disabled people. They wouldn't have dared, you know. But Starmer, who I don't know. Okay, so he represented a couple of people in the 90s from the libel case, blah blah blah, you know. But let's face it, Mr. CPS, for years and years, he's an establishment figure. He's got in, he's nobbled the Labour Party, he's destroyed it under this you know, anti-Semitism smear that was put out, the big lie, you know. And that's where we're at now. Hopefully, you know, an alternative will come to that, you know, out of Corbyn's new party. But in the meantime, direct action, civil disobedience is our only recourse to holding these people
Well, what
back.
about you? What about Nigel Farage? He is apparently, if there's an election tomorrow, which there won't be, but if there is, Farage is going to have a 50-seat majority.
Exactly. The Labour Party, with their centrist policies, not actually dealing with what people have been screaming for all these years of austerity and Tory government and, you know, misrule, you know, been denied winter fuel help, denied, you know, windfall taxes. Now they're hammering disabled people, you know, complicit in a genocide in Gaza. You know, the Labour Party I call them a gateway drug to fascists, because they're going to spirit in, and maybe that's the agenda. Maybe we'll break the Tory Labour Party. We'll disenfranchise people. We'll disenchant people so that they don't bother voting. There's nothing worth voting for, because let's face it, if you wait 16 years for a glimmer of hope, and you know, just to watch a huge majority squandered by Blair too. Then, you know, yeah, you're not going to bother, or the other lot are going to get in, the other lot being the fascists. You know, and maybe that's the thing, you know.
Yeah,
I
well,
don't know.
maybe. The amazing thing about the general election last year in 2024 July was that every other word that was uttered by the Labour Party was change, change. Of course, there's been
Yeah,
absolutely no
change.
change, no change. Everything is just exactly the same, if not worse. But anyway, look, I think what you talking about this Labour Party being a gateway drug for fascism is quite appropriate because you do this great dictator speech, Neil, don't you?
That's right, yeah. And I've actually learned it. Yeah, pleased to have learned it. I've drilled it and often walk down the street doing it and over and over and over and over again. So hopefully I won't lose
I
my
mean, it's
way.
actually Charlie Chaplin's film, The Great Dictator. Was that actually out before World War II? Because it was pretty amazing, wasn't it?
I think it was conceptualized around about 39, and I think it came out in 1940. Hitler apparently saw it twice because they were born the same month of the same year, those two.
Yeah, and remember, of
You
course, it
know,
was made in Hollywood, which were the Americans at that point were not in the war, so it must have played quite an important part in, in galvanizing American public opinion too.
yeah, definitely. Although Chaplin's, you know, he said because it's lampooning fascists or Hitler, you know, you know, without in the hindsight, without knowing the severe, the absolute homicidal lunacy and cruelty of the Nazis, he said that he would, there's no way that he would try to get a laugh out of that situation, you know. Hitler apparently saw it twice in his Bavarian mountain retreat. No one knows what he thought of it, but I always said this about, you know, when I've dressed up as the Great Dictator, but it's like you. I mean, the other day, this policeman came up to me and he said, "Look, considering everything that's happening at the moment, I think it's a bit inappropriate of you to dress like that at the moment, right in front of this Al Jazeera woman who piped up and said, don't you know who this is Adenoid Heinkel, the Great Dictator." And this cop had obviously never heard of the film. He just thought that Hitler's turned up at this pro-Palestinian kind of march or demo. And she had a tune about the film, and he had to go away because he obviously wanted to nick me for breach of the peace, dressed up as a Nazi. And yeah, and he came back. She's always spoken to a colleague, and the colleague probably knew the film reference. I always said, just Google it, mate. You want to know what, you know, just Google The Great Dictator, you know. So
Yeah, the
yeah,
other thing to
so I do.
mention is that I think it's well worth it actually, in that when the Nazi Party first came to power, 1933, I think it was. Anyway, when they first came to power, they were embraced as sort of heroic people because they had helped to recover Germany from a terrible economic situation, and there was sort of I was almost reminded of Blair, when Blair got elected in 97, there was loads of cheering, hooray, we've got rid of the Tories and blah blah blah, but Blair ended up being something horrific. So there seems to me much of politics is like this, is where you think you're going to get one thing, actually what you get is a nightmare.
One of the best, really the only things that really came out of the Blair times really was the Human Rights Act, you know, the Article 10, the Human Rights Act. That sort of legislation still holds true today. I won a couple of cases on my right to free expression. But beyond that, I mean, it's
Well,
just
there's a
pitiful.
Good
It's just,
Friday Agreement as well, the in Northern Ireland,
oh
although
yeah, actually, yeah.
some
Kyoto as
say
well
that,
was,
so there's some
no.
say that that was really, really much more about massive bombs going off in the city of London than it was about Tony Blair and Mo Mowlam.
Yeah, exactly. There were a few things that he did, but then again, I mean, that's where my character, the Charlie X character, came in during the SOCPA years, you know, Brian Orr years. That was pretty much their knee-jerk reaction to fear of terrorism on the streets of London was to take people's rights to protest away, you know, and that's pretty much what they did, and that's how I came about, really.
So
Is
Charlie X is
like,
his name. Can you go
yeah,
into the Charlie X persona?
Charlie X by any mimes necessary. Black and white power by any mimes necessary. Pulling funny faces outside the wrong places. Basically blundering into situations like the protest exclusion zone and falling foul of the law, which is what I did a few times. I got arrested. Actually, the first day I went out, I got arrested. Dressed, I used to put the permanent marker on my, do the tash with permanent marker. I didn't even use kind of makeup. It was very, very crude looking chaplain, but I got done. I was carrying a placard that said, "No comment." It's just like playing around. Another time I had not allowed and right to remain silent. So I was sort of playing around with that. And then I went off, at my SOCP years for 2006. And then I went off to South Africa and I spent about 8 years out there protesting pretty much against what was happening there, which was, serious corruption, very, very scary. Guy called Zuma in control in cahoots with the Russians and various other mafia family, and trying to bring nuclear tenders in, trying to bring fracking in, trying to get rid of all sorts of free speech. So that's where Charlie X spent 8 years fighting against, for the Right to Know campaign and various other campaigns, and trying to stop the nuclear deal, and which we did, trying to stop fracking, which we did. And we held them back on the free speech stuff. So it kind of cut my teeth in South Africa, really, as the character, and then came back for Trump's inaugural thing in 2017. And one of my first arrests coming back was outside Downing Street against Save the NHS. That was. And there's also Brexit stuff that I was doing. It's just ever since and spy cop stuff. Just I've got three characters. One's the great dictator, one's Charlie X, the little tramp, and one's the policeman, kind of PC Plod type character where I've actually got a policeman's helmet now. So just bringing them out, although now I'm banned from Westminster. It's that's my stage. I'm banned from the stage, basically.
Well, I can't imagine you being banned. I think you might, Ch Charlie X might have to accidentally blunder back in there at some point. But anyway, so the Great Dictator speech, you've altered it a bit, haven't you?
I have. I brought it up to date. I've lost the references to Gentiles and 17th chapter of St. Luke. And it's all about instead of although I have used it in the past, instead of soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes, I'd say police, and I've belted that out a few times to the police. I've just changed it around, and I'm kind of tinkering with it often. I'm thinking, although it's the speech is connected to democracy, obviously, but I think, well, listen, people voted for Hitler, yeah? And so democracy, what we're talking about, I think, is humanity. That really cuts it. We're fighting for humanity, not democracy, because let's face it, people voted for Trump. Democracy is at the beck and call of, news spin and, well, now, Cambridge Analytica, and all the kind of internet stuff that's going down, trying to mold people's opinions. So yeah, it's not about democracies for me anymore. It's so much about humanity. That's what it is. So yeah, I've changed a few words that made it less sexist, made it less Christian. Mentioned the internet and rather than wirelesses. Yeah, just brought it up to date. And just belt it out, really. And I've done it a few times. The seats of power. I actually doing it under Chaplin one day, and this park warden, like Parky, turns up in the middle of nowhere, and he's like, "What are you doing? What are you doing here? This is Parliament Square. You're not allowed to protest in Parliament Square." And it's like news to me. I'm under Churchill. Although he was in blood sucking murderer, but is known as someone who stood up against tyranny. And I'm like, mate, this is Charlie's under, it's a perfect place for me, right? This is where it is. No, you can't protest it. It's like so many parts of London where you can't protest now. Or even in Parliament Square, you're going to get a parkie turning up saying you're breaking some bylaw. So that was one of the last times I did it. When I was outside Downing, I saw my disability as a, it's like you don't have to lock on, you don't have to glue yourself or anything. You just have to sit there and forget your Zimmer frame,
So for many people who are disabled, the last thing they're thinking about is sticking themselves out to get arrested. I mean, what is it? What would you say to someone who's saying that, this whole idea of being arrested, etc., as a disabled person is an impossible thing, or even as an able-bodied person to contemplate?
Frailty becomes a super, your super strength, really, your special strength, really, against the kryptonite of able-bodiedism. You just yeah it's empowerment. It's like, I mean, when I first started doing the Charlie, I felt like broken glass. I was being cut through with the ankylosing spondylitis at that time, and like severe arthritis, and it's freezing, and but once you're dressed up, you and once you're engaged in civil disobedience or empowerment, you kind of forget all that. It's you hooked into a wider story, and you forget about your individual pains and aches. You just kind of like lose yourself in it. It's like therapy. And I also think that in this crazy times, just in general, I think activism is therapy. It's the only therapy available. Otherwise you're internalizing it, and you're just turning it into illness inside of you, because this is not the way we're supposed to be. These are not the values we aspire to, but also disability, like I say, you don't have to lock on, you don't have to glue yourself to anything, you just have to sit there and forget your Zimmer frame.
How do the
And
police react to you as a disabled person? I mean, do you, for example, take your mob they take them your mobility scooter with you into the cell?
Not into the cell, no. They have to get each station, I think, has got a wheelchair. They haven't got a Zimmer frame, and they've got no grab bars. The bed's too low. They wouldn't let me use my extended arm because they thought it was a weapon. I need that to put clothes on or pick things up off the floor because I've got a fused back. So that there's a lot of work to be done. NETPOL, I think I should get in touch with them and tell them a few things. In terms of making suitable, the whole system at the moment is not suitable for disabled people, as you were just like excluded from that other part of another part of society that excludes us, where you'd imagine that they would have a designated police cell that was just disabled friendly in each station. But obviously there's the cost. And I think also with this DPAC, this welfare not warfare push that was going on at the moment, we were just borderline, we were going to kick off. We were like in the old Direct Action Network days, we were going to start to cause trouble. It'd only take about four or five of us on mobility scooters. I'm sorry, but I don't want to be a dictator. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Muslim, black, white, refugee, migrant. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise anyone. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everybody. The way of life can be free and beautiful. But we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned man's soul, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into bloodshed and misery. We've developed speed but shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance now leaves us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the internet have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in people, cries out for universal brotherhood and sisterhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent lives. To those people, I promise, the hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people shall return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Police, don't give yourselves to brutes, men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourself to these unnatural men with machine minds and machine hearts. You're not machines. You're not cattle. You're human. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate. Only the unloved hates the unloved and the unnatural. Police, don't fight for slavery. Fight for liberty. Because you, the people, have the power. The power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. So, in the name of humanity, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world, a decent world that gives people the chance to work, that gives youth a future and old age security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power, but they lie. They do not fulfill that promise, and they never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason, a world where science and progress leads to everyone's happiness. People, in the name of humanity, let us all unite. Shalom. Salam. Peace.
Wow, Neil Goodwin, thanks very much for joining us.
Ah, welcome. Thank you.